From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton.
All members vote or desire to vote.
Members, this budget is not our preference.
Share the pain.
We've got to stop the game.
No baloney.
Taxes, taxes, taxes.
The next step's the governor's.
Only the good Lord knows.
Mr. Secretary, call the roll.
And those are the voices from the Capitol that can only mean it's one thing. It's time for Capitol Chat, again, as we do every week, talking about what's going on under the dome downtown. We're going to be looking back today at 2001 with our indefatigable Capitol reporter, Ben Adler. Ben, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks. I would love to look back at the year 2001 in the state capitol.
That's old news. Yeah, yes. Okay.
I was not around to cover the Capitol then, unfortunately.
Okay, how about this year then?
You sure?
Yeah. Let's do this one.
Okay, cool.
So most recent and everything.
Well, to start with, we wanted to just take a listen back to some of the big moments of the year, and it seemed like at the national level, the big buzzword was jobs, jobs, jobs. Here in Sacramento at the state capitol, it was budget, 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 and a new governor.
That I take this obligation freely.
That I take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservation.
Without any mental reservation.
Or?
Really, no mental reservations. Choices have to be made, and difficult decisions taken. At this stage of my life, I've not come here to embrace delay and denial.
This morning, I'm proposing a balanced budget that cuts $12.5 billion from proposed state spending and gives California a vast and historic restructuring of government functions. If we don't have the taxes, it's going to be extremely difficult, even draconian, if I could use that word.
Good morning. My name's Senator Bob Dutton. I'm here with the Republican Senate Caucus. We are here to make it clear once and again that the reason that there is no budget deal is that the governor, the Democratic majority in the legislature, and their allies refuse to allow the voters the opportunity to reform pensions and control state overspending.
The Democrats in both the Senate and in the Assembly have now joined with the administration and myself, and we have a very good plan going forward for the budget. We do expect more revenues in the budget year coming up, but in case we're over-optimistic, we have severe trigger cuts that will be triggered and go into effect, and those are real.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Mac Taylor, legislative analyst, and earlier today, my office put out California's fiscal outlook on the budget situation. By the end of that year, June 30th of 2013, we have to come up with solutions, either expenditure reductions and/or revenue increases of almost $13 billion, in order for the state to finish in the black.
So today, the trigger cuts are going into effect, but fortunately, not the full $2.4 billion, but actually slightly less than a billion. That's the story today in a nutshell. $1 billion of cuts, more to follow in January, and hopefully not any more to follow in November, because we will have more trigger cuts premised on whether or not people vote for taxes.
And that's Governor Jerry Brown talking about the state budget at the Capitol early this month and giving a preview about next year's budget. Ben, it seems like it's hard to believe that he has only been governor for a month. This has just been going on and on and on.
Well, the budget certainly was a problem long before Jerry Brown was sworn
in.
He has said that he wants to solve the fiscal crisis in California once and for all. He made some headway on it this year. He did not get as far as he wanted, and it is easy for his critics to say he didn't do what he said he was going to do. On the other hand, it's only 1 year of a four-year term, and so there's a lot more time. So I yesterday called up a couple of strategists, one Democrat, Jason Kinney, who worked in Gray Davis's administration, the other Republican, Aaron McClure, who worked for Governor Schwarzenegger, a Republican, and I kind of took the Capitol Public Radio performance review, and I asked them about four different categories.
Oh, okay. So you're their job knowledge, for instance?
Yes, exactly. Skills and knowledge required for the job, ability to understand the required duties, responsibilities, skills, and procedures. So I started giving this performance evaluation to Jerry Brown, and I asked Jason Kinney, is the first person we'll hear, a Democrat, followed by Aaron McClure, what they thought of the governor's job knowledge.
Wow. Is there an A++? Because by that measure, I mean, it would be hard to find a more experienced person for the job and someone who's sort of seen it all and done it all, but is also kind of creative enough to kind of handle the unique hyper-partisanship of the modern era, which is much different than when in his first and second terms of governor. So by that measure, I'd say exceeds expectations.
I'm not sure if we've had a governor in the history of the state with more knowledge and know-how and ability to solve problems. He certainly understands government. He's been in government his entire life. I think the question is, how does he apply that knowledge? How does he apply that know-how to solve problems? And up to this point, although he knows a lot about government, he's not been able to kind of translate that knowledge into fixing problems.
All right. Well, those are the first question in the job evaluation of Jerry Brown at the end of his first year by a Republican and a Democrat. And Ben Adler of the Capitol Bureau is here doing that with us. The second is you asked the question about their productivity and cost effectiveness.
Yeah. The amount of acceptable work performed minimizes or eliminates waste, performs as efficiently as possible without jeopardizing quality. Volume is directed, more than expected, less than expected, and recommending areas where productivity can be improved. So again, first we'll hear from Democratic strategist Jason Kinney, and then from Republican Aaron McClure.
That's an easy one for him, too, because, you know, it'd be hard to find a more frugal governor, if not a more frugal elected official in America. He didn't make a lot of noise about blowing up boxes and reducing government waste. He just went out and did it. He did it with cell phones. He's done it with government-owned vehicles. Anyone who's been to the governor's office and sees all the empty office space knows that he is doing more with less than any government official, certainly any governor we've had in recent memory. He's asking each staffer in his office to do more than they've ever had to do before. And so far, it's worked for him.
You can't argue he's cut spending. You know, he certainly cut spending. I think that there was a lot of room to cut spending. You know, he did a lot of kind of optical things I think were smart politically, like getting rid of the cell phones and cracking down the cars and hiring freeze. A lot of the things that we did in the Schwarzenegger administration, he continued to do those. But as far as how much did that matter, I think that there is a point in which you start to jeopardize transparency for austerity. And I think that he went at times a bit far in cutting back to the point where, you know, he wasn't explaining to the people through the press exactly what it is that he was doing. He wasn't explaining his agenda.
I think that we're all probably grateful that we don't have a member of each party assessing our job performances at this point. That's two questions. The third would be their quality of work. What was Jerry Brown's quality of work according to these two guys?
Well, the question is, what about the thoroughness and accuracy of the work performed? Was it performed to establish standards? Were mistakes made? Did he show good judgment in completing job tasks? Once again, Jason Kinney, a Democratic strategist, followed by Republican Aaron McClure.
On state government's first priority and his first campaign promise, which was fixing the budget and the revenue mess, I think he's far exceeded expectations. He's also done something very interesting. He's neutralized our party's greatest natural vulnerability, and that's on pension reform, which relates to the budget, by putting out a fairly rigorous and serious plan, and one that a lot of folks on the progressive left don't like. A lot of these things are we're betting on the come here. These things have not completely been accomplished. So the proof will be in the product at the end of the year, at the end of 2012. But I think he's done everything in his power to create an environment where those things can be successful.
First of all, to be fair, this is year one, a 4, maybe 8-year administration. So, you know, he still certainly has time to do things. But the approach he took, the strategy that he took this year obviously did not work. I don't think by any measure you can say this first year was a success in and of itself. He came in saying, I'm going to solve the budget and try to create jobs. He didn't solve the budget. We're upwards of $13 billion out of whack right now. And he also was not able to work with Republicans to get a jobs package done. So through that limited agenda that he had so far, he's really not succeeded at it.
We're hearing evaluations of Jerry Brown's job performance from his first year as governorship, and that was Aaron McClure. And before him is Jason Kinney.
Yes.
Of the Democrats. And the final question on the job evaluation is you have to kind of look at this category and with a little bit of pain and laughter at the same time, because it's about teamwork and cooperation.
Yeah, actually, I miswrote that. That's my fault. Teamwork and communication.
Oh, okay.
My mistake on that.
Idea, though.
Yes, it does. And it does look at cooperation and flexibility. Does he work helpfully with others? Does he respond positively to supervision? which I guess when you're talking about the governor, it's hard to say if he has a supervisor. He has several million of them, mm-hmm. but he does not have any individual directly above him. Does he actively contribute to the team's goals? Does he accept constructive criticism? Does he make an effort to comply with direction? So that is what goes into teamwork and communication, at least on the Capitol Public Radio performance review. And so we will hear one final time from Democratic strategist Jason Kinney, who was a senior communications advisor and speechwriter to Democratic Governor Gray Davis, and Republican Aaron McClear, who was press secretary to former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger.
If there was an area that people were going to nitpick or criticize, it might be that. The governor has done something extraordinary on the budget, and that is keeping a coalition together that involves labor, business, tribes, and every other interest in California. The part that I think people will point to is when it comes down to a complete negotiation, right, a negotiation on details, we haven't had that kind of perfect product yet that's come out of the other end. We don't have results yet. But I think they're coming. So I guess that's more of a, I'm going to leave that question open.
I think he seemed to give a genuine effort to work across the aisle to bring Republicans and Democrats together. It's not an easy job. I can tell you from working for someone, Governor Schwarzenegger, who had a much different approach to governing, doing events constantly, talking about his agenda, trying to sell his agenda. Governor Brown is not out there. He has a very limited agenda, and he's not out there talking about it too much. Now, both men, I would say, probably wish they would have had more success. So it really shows you that no matter what approach a governor takes, the system is so flawed that it makes it very difficult for any governor to get anything done. But as far as teamwork with him working with Republicans, it's disappointing that he came in saying that he was going to be the person who brought Republicans and Democrats together to solve problems. And now, less than a year later, he's saying he's no longer talking to Republicans. That's not a good thing.
And that's Jason Kinney, a Republican strategist, a Democratic strategist, and Aaron McClear before him, a former spokesman for Governor Schwarzenegger. And Ben Adler from Capitol Public Radio's Capitol Bureau is here. That was the assessment of Jerry Brown, his first year in office. Of course, he's got three more years, and it may take that long to get things in order, at least. So what's looking forward in January? We're going to have a little break now, and then what's coming up in 2012?
Well, really, the lawmakers have been on break since first week of September or so. The governor's been at the Capitol here and there, but things certainly slowed down while lawmakers were away. It will absolutely pick up starting in the first week of January when lawmakers return. They restart their legislative session, the second year of their two-year session. And for lawmakers, they'll face a deadline at the end of January. Any bills that that were introduced last year that did not make it out of the first chamber, as in the chamber of origin. So if an assembly bill needs to make it out of the assembly, that needs to be out of the assembly over to the Senate by the end of January, or else those bills are dead. So lawmakers will face some urgency on their projects with that deadline. Meantime, the governor will be extraordinarily busy. He will be proposing his budget for the upcoming fiscal year, the one that begins July 1st, 2012, and he'll be doing that by January 10th, and he'll be giving his second State of the State address, and that, we are told, will be in the second half of January. So a very busy January coming up. The budget is not going away. It will continue to be an issue. And of course, let's not forget, it is clear that there will be some form of tax measure as well as a spending cap measure and probably a dozen other ballot measures on the November general election ballot. That will be, as Governor Brown promised last year, a war of all against all. And so 2012 certainly to be a year full of intrigue at the state capitol.
So we're not looking forward to any Christmas miracle, and we're all going to come back in January, and everybody's going to cooperate and get everything done, right?
Earlier this week, the governor was at the menorah lighting, and he did talk about needing a few miracles in Sacramento. So whether it's a Christmas miracle or a Hanukkah miracle, I think the governor not necessarily holding his breath waiting for one.
Okay. Ben Adler of Capitol Public Radio's Capitol Bureau, thanks for coming in. And we will talk to you in the first week of January and look forward to a little bit more detail then, right?
Yeah. Thanks for having me. And Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy holidays to everyone.
Thank you. You too. You're listening to Insight from Capitol Public Radio. Coming up, the Strong Mayor Initiative Revisited.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Insight is also online, and to tell us a little bit more about what's going on at capradio.org/insight is assistant producer Lynn Weaver.
Good morning, David.
Morning.
Insight is taking time off for the holidays and will return on Tuesday, January 3rd. Tomorrow, you'll hear Capital Public Radio's health documentary dealing with diabetes. And next week, we'll air Radiolab, a show that weaves stories and science into sound and music-rich documentaries. Tell us if you like our holiday specials by going to our Facebook page, Insight on Capital Public Radio. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email to insight@capradio.org.
Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you.
And looking forward to those Radiolab shows. Those are really, really great. And the diabetes documentary also. Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson is up for re-election next year after what has been a tumultuous time for Sacramento, perhaps the city's most difficult period in recent history. His poll ratings are high, and at least so far, no one is running against him next year. But his attempts to rewrite the city charter to allow for a stronger executive mayor have angered many and split people within the local government. This week, Johnson's chief of staff announced that the mayor will attempt for a third time to put what has been dubbed the Strong Mayor Initiative on the ballot to coincide with his re-election. Here to make the mayor's case for what has been renamed the Checks and Balances Act of 2012 is the mayor's chief of staff, Kunal Merchant. Kunal, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, David. Good morning.
Let's talk about before we go into the details of what you're proposing. What does the mayor think about what is broken that this would fix?
That's a great question, and I think, you know, fundamentally what we're trying to do here is, you know, simply put, just put voters first and make the government work for them again. We hear the same thing all around town when we're talking to all sorts of different people. It's just that people want some very basic things out of the government right now. They want leaders who are helping people get back to work, using tax dollars wisely, you know, keeping streets safe. They don't care about these political food fights and bickering. They just want to see problem solving and results and compromise. And they're just not seeing that right now. And you see it in so many different ways. People are frustrated with the economy, and they don't think that the city's doing a good job to improve the business climate. They don't think that we're doing enough to promote public safety, especially when we're cutting cops. They don't think that we're doing enough to manage their tax dollars wisely, certainly before coming back to ask for more. And we think the root cause of that is just the way the system as a whole works. It's bigger than one issue. It's just that fundamentally this is not a system designed to respond directly to voters and be accountable to them. And until we change that, it's going to be hard to make progress in all those issues that voters care about.
Okay, and so this is a different proposal. This has been proposed twice before, and while it had its supporters, it had a lot of people were pretty opposed to it. What kind of changes have you made this time to try to appeal to those people as well?
Absolutely, yeah. So this plan is a lot more broad and balanced than it was before. In the first plan, that Strong Mayor Initiative back in 2008, we got the accountability piece right, which is this idea that all the major leaders of the city need to be directly accountable to voters. But what we missed was, in terms of the plan, getting it balanced. There weren't enough checks and balances. So we're all for, you know, different folks within the government having a little bit more tools to get things done, but there need to be checks and balances. And so this plan has a lot more safeguards against individuals and different groups. It separates executive and legislative powers, but it makes sure that they're checking and balance on each other. We're also adding a lot more ethics and transparency reforms, because we heard from the community that said, look, you know, we want to see more of what's going on in government. We want access to more of the documents, the information. Things are done too much behind closed doors. And then lastly, we added in the parameters to create an independent redistricting commission, largely out of frustrations folks had earlier this year with how the redistricting process worked. And again, things done behind closed doors, not in the voters' best interest. So it's a lot broader. We've scaled back a lot of the things that folks didn't like. And added in things that are popular. And so far, people are really appreciative of that.
And so this isn't just about the mayor's powers relative to the city council. There are other issues involved. I mean, redistricting was a huge controversy this year.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is really more about the system. And, you know, yesterday we rolled this out, and it was important that we had about 40 to 50 folks there who are very supportive of this plan. And this is bigger than the mayor. Obviously, he plays a key role in this, and he's very, very supportive of what we're trying to do. But this is about making the system work better, not only for this mayor, but for all mayors going forward and for all councils and ultimately the public. And so, yes, this is a lot more broad. It's a lot more balanced, and it's about what the people need to get what the people deserve from their government.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because the rollout, actually, the mayor was conspicuously absent, and we have you on, chief of staff, rather than the mayor talking about it. Is that a way of sort of distancing him, not identifying him with it so much?
I wouldn't frame it that way. I mean, again, the mayor's always been a very stand-up leader, and he's always been very straightforward with what he believes. And this is something he fundamentally believes is critical, that you cannot have results without accountability. And until we create accountability in the government, we're just not going to get there. Now, that said, he also wants to give the other folks in this movement a voice. And, you know, he has talked about this topic many times and will continue to do so. But this is really about all the other people, getting them a chance to have their voice heard, having the folks who care about public safety talk about why the current system is not working for them, having, you know, people who care about jobs talk about why the business climate is so terrible and how the city's failure to act is costing them jobs and money. And that's all this is. This is about rounding it out and giving more people a chance to be involved, because this is really about the city at the end of the day.
I'm speaking with Kunal Merchant. He's the chief of staff for Mayor Kevin Johnson about the new proposal for a rewriting of the city charter. And we've mentioned that there are other people who have been opposed to this. And we're joined by one of them. This is Bill Camp, who's executive secretary of the Sacramento Labor Council, AFL-CIO, and a longtime actor in city affairs. Bill Camp, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be included.
Good, sure. You've been opposed, I think, to the two previous charter rewrites. What do you think about this new version?
Well, we want to see it. We just had it rolled out yesterday. We assume this is the one this is the final version. I know this has been going through a lot of changes. We'll take this very seriously. We'll spend some time looking at it. We'll schedule meetings of our leadership to review it, to figure if there are portions of this that we think are appropriate or not. We'll look at this not from the point of view of the Chamber of Commerce. We'll look at this from the point of view of what the middle-class people in this city believe is in their interest. And quite frankly, I was a little concerned about who was speaking for yesterday, because they weren't, you know, it sounded almost like a Republican bashing of the Democratic members of the city council. And I don't know that that's the approach that should be used.
Okay, I don't know who you're referring to.
Well, Roger Nilo doesn't live in Sacramento. He's a Republican from the east part of the county. Van Fleck doesn't live in Sacramento. He's a Republican. I don't even know if he lives in the county. The land use lawyer lives in Davis. And the minister's a Republican. So at least four of those people who spoke, okay, you know, one of whom lives in the city. So I'm just saying we need to look at this not just from a partisan point of view, what these Republican advocates think about it, but let's look at it from the point of view of all the people in the city, and let's hear from the broad diversity of the city.
Do you mind if I say something on that?
Well, hang on a second. I do want to bring it back. We want to keep it focused on not so much the personalities, but on the actual change to the charter and what that might mean in terms of the next 50 years is really what the change we're talking about is here, right?
With regard to the actual changes, there's some things that are being proposed, at least what I've seen in some of the drafts, that we could go ahead and adopt now, and I think it would be a great idea to do it. It doesn't involve restructuring fundamentally the way we make decisions. It involves openness. We're certainly committed to that openness process, and we think we ought to go forward with those portions that we can adopt and do those without having to go through a long debate about throwing everything into the mix.
Right.
With regards to the fundamental structure of the redistricting, I was on the redistricting council.
Right.
The committee, and watch the manipulations by the mayor's appointee and Jay Chenier's appointee and Angelique Ashby's appointee and a couple of others who held secret meetings, and they all voted, you know, the way they planned it in their meetings. And I certainly was appalled at the way they operated. But that was not a question of the structuring of the reapportionment. That was a question of how people behaved who are on that commission. So if we're going to do reapportionment, you can follow a model like the state has done, but it needs to be much more clear what we're asking people to vote on in terms of how it will operate. So that's a very different conversation. We have plenty. We got 9 years to talk about that and come up with some consensus that would honor the concerns We don't need to do that in June. With regards to the question of how to divide up the power of who makes the decisions, that's something that's a critical concern for the community, broadly speaking. And you know, we are committed to looking at this. We're committed to thinking about it very seriously. We'll have our leadership review it, and we'll come and express our opinion to the city council when they get ready to hear it.
Okay. We also should note that the city attorney has to look over the language of this and okay it as well. Kunal, you wanted to respond to Bill Camp's comments, particularly about redistricting?
All right. No, actually, the issue before, I think Bill brings up a really good point, which is, you know, again, people wanting us to have something that kind of transcends the petty politics and the partisanship. And again, one of the most exciting aspects of this plan for us is the fact that it is truly bipartisan. You know, we committed at the beginning of our term to be bipartisan, and some of the biggest advocates for this form of government are folks like Jerry Brown, our governor, who made this change back in Oakland, and Gavin Newsom, our lieutenant governor, who was very successful in San Francisco. And so we actually see it as a positive that this is a set of issues that has had a long tradition of Democratic support, and now we're able to bring Democrats and Republicans and independents together on a plan that, as Bill mentioned, we're getting a lot of support both in the city and the region. And then the second part of this is, you know, this importance in a bad economy of bringing business and labor together. And, you know, business folks have this plan has appealed to them from the point of view of, you know, accountability and having an executive who's got some tools to make decisions and get results. But what's been exciting is, you know, we've had 3 years now on this issue, and we've met with Bill and others in labor darn near a dozen times. I actually just met with Bill and some folks on Monday, and, you know, there are people who are excited about this and see this as really being a plan that responded to a lot of the concerns for those first couple of drafts. And, you know, we've even talked to people up and down the state and in the country in the labor movement, and there are many, many cities around the country that have very strong labor movements that absolutely love this form of government, because just like voters, they have a direct line into the chief executive. And so we're hopeful that this can be another example of how business and labor can work together on this proposal, the same way we've done with other issues like green and the entertainment and sports complex.
I'm speaking with Kunal Merchant, who's the chief of staff for Mayor Kevin Johnson, and with Bill Camp, who's the executive secretary of the Sacramento Labor Council. One thing I wanted to point out is that, and we're running a little bit long, but this is something that is going to there's a vote on the 17th in January, and this is a vote to put this on the ballot, correct? This is not an actual vote on the Strong Mayor or the Checks and Balances Act, correct?
Well, the council has some flexibility. What we wanted to do is we wanted to put out some language for the community and the council to look at, and so that's what we did yesterday. It's now everyone in the community will have a chance to look at really in detail what we're proposing, and then meanwhile the city attorney is preparing an independent analysis of how this stacks up with other plans that have been put forth around the city and the country, and then give that information to the council. And then on the 17th, the council has a couple options. They can sort of say, hey, we like the plan as it is, and let's go ahead and vote it on the ballot. Or we had a couple of questions about this and this. Are there ways to enhance that? And then maybe wait a week or two. But the key thing is they would have between mid-January and probably mid-February to, you know, finalize any tweaks. And then, yes, they would call it to the ballot. And then we'd be able to do what, you know, Bill and many others have suggested, which is put this before the voters at the same time as the mayoral election. And we think that's sort of the final and best way to do it is, you know, choose your mayor and choose your governance system and let the people decide, let the voters in a democracy decide how they want Sacramento to structure itself going forward.
Okay. Well, Bill Camp, do you have any last word for us?
Yeah. Let's make clear, Bill Camp didn't suggest we put it on the ballot in June. That's not Bill Camp. Which Bill Camp he's talking about, but this Bill Camp did not say we should put this before the voters in June. What we said is we'll look at it, we'll study it, we'll come before the city council on the 17th. It will probably not be voted on the 17th. The public needs to have an opportunity to weigh in on this issue to see what they think. But we don't approach making a fundamental change in the power distribution of the city lightly. And we don't also, at least I'm not comfortable with doing everything at once. If you want to change the way we make decisions, let's do it with some thought. Let's do it with some a piece at a time. There may be people who want to do everything all at once, I've talked to labor leaders in San Francisco. They don't like it. I've talked to labor leaders in Oakland. They don't like it. I've talked to labor leaders in San Diego. They don't like it. So it's not true that everybody thinks this is God's gift to heaven. It needs thorough review by the public, and certainly we will do that. We honor that request, that we take it seriously. We are. And we'll come forward with our perspective about it.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Bill Camp. And we've been talking about this for about 3 years now. So hopefully something will come about next month, and we'll be moving forward or one way or the other. Bill Camp from the Sacramento Labor Council, thanks for joining us. And Kunal Merchant from the mayor's office, thank you as well.
All right. Thanks, David.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, comedian Dave Attell. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Now it's time to find out what's happening in the news today with senior editor Alan Ray, who joins us from the newsroom. Alan, what's going on?
Well, 'tis the season to be thankful for small favors, David. And when you live in a Sierra timber town, small is a relative term. So this actually seems a pretty big story. The U.S. Forest Service has come up with a grant that will save 200 jobs at a company called Sierra Forest Products. It's a family-owned company in a severely depressed area. The town is Tarabella. The jobs pay well. The mill is the last one in the Southern Sierra that works on maintaining and improving forest health, largely by reducing wildfire fuel loads, thinning forests, that sort of thing, in the Sierra Stanislaus and Sequoia National Forests. So, Merry Christmas. Hard to imagine, maybe, but Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell is beginning to sound like a peacemaker. The New York Times is reporting the Kentucky Republican is suggesting the House pass the 2-month temporary Social Security tax holiday the Senate's already approved, with Senate Democrats agreeing in turn to form a negotiating committee that would develop a long-term agreement, which is what the House said it wanted all along. Still waiting for the House Republican response. We may have it by the time we get to All Things Considered this afternoon at 3:30 on Capital Public Radio.
All right. Thanks, Alan.
All right. You take care.
Comedian Dave Attell has been doing stand-up comedy for nearly 25 years, and during that time he's done a couple series, Insomniac and his new Dave Attell's Old Porn. He's also done countless tours, a number of HBO and Comedy Central specials, DVDs, you name it. He's been around long enough to have seen significant changes in the comedy audience itself. He'll be performing two nights in Sacramento's Punchline, starting with a week tonight. I spoke to him in advance of those shows, and I asked him to listen to a clip from his 2008 HBO special.
There's no commercials for Jägermeister.
There's none. I've never seen one.
Have you?
No, I haven't.
Right? There should be some, right? So you know what you're getting into.
But there aren't any.
But I thought of some. Do you guys want to hear it?
Do you? Do you or don't you?
You do? Okay. Commercials for Jägermeister. A guy comes out of a hedge. He's covered in mud and blood. He's holding one high heel shoe. Did I just eat a stripper? Jaeger.
There you go.
To the point. Direct. How about another one? Can you do another one? I think you can. A little girl is sitting on the swing, not swinging. A tear rolls down her cheek. Where's Daddy? Jaeger.
There you go.
Dave Attell, welcome to Insight.
Well, thanks for having me, Dave. It's weird I had to hear myself trying to be funny.
You don't like that, huh?
Yeah, I'm not one of these guys that kind of likes hearing my own stuff. I kind of, it makes me cringe, and I'm sure a lot of the audience agrees with me. Now that it's just like, oh, God, I can't believe, oh. You know, and every joke I've done, like after you put it on tape or CD or something like that, then you're always like, oh, man, I could have done it better, or like I thought of a better punchline, or, you know, it's hard.
Uh-huh.
It's not like a song, but it is kind of.
And do you, how often do you, or how long do you work jokes over then?
Like all the time, forever. Like I tell every joke differently pretty much every other time I do them, and, and it's mostly out of boredom, but also just because, like, I'll be like, hey, you know, let's try it this way, you know, just to kind of keep it, you know, interesting for me and the crowd or the fans of comedy who've heard it, you know. But people really want to hear the stuff that you've done, like on a CD or something. Like, they want to hear it like that. So I don't really do old material. I try and always try and work on the next hour, you know. Is this making any sense, or am I being crazier?
That makes sense to me. It makes sense to me. Are you so? Does this stuff in that case? I would assume that it kind of comes easily to you to be funny or to come up with jokes, that you're always sort of churning them.
No, I'll tell you, there's some guys that have amazing turnaround with their material, like Louis C.K., who is like one of the best comics ever. He can put out a new CD, DVD, like every year. You know, it takes me like 5 years. You know, I was really good in the beginning. I was like every 3 years. You know, I would do something like, you know, a new special or something like that. And then as you get older, you realize it's like, you know, not so much writing the joke. It's like coming up with new setups and situations and stuff. And, you know, a lot of it's just sad old stuff. And I don't know what people want to hear. So it's harder as you get older.
And why is that? Because you would think that something that you've done for a long time and that you're just a well-oiled machine, is it something inherent in comedy that it's harder to find things funnier as you get older?
Well, I think there's a lot more comedy out there. So, like, you know, if you're like me, like you're like obsessively checking stuff, you know, it's really hard to come up with like original stuff. But, you know, usually if I hear a joke like some I'm working on or whatever, I'll either change it or stop doing it. And that's just how I work. But I guess the heart of it is just that as we move forward, you know, the crowd's more politically correct than when I first started. And there's a lot of things that like are now considered taboo subjects, you know, race, religion, all that kind of stuff that like people don't want to hear or they just groan at. So, you know, stuff that is just really kind of a sarcastic take comes like this big, you know, show-stopping moment, and then you got to recover with like three or four. Can I curse on this or no?
No.
Okay, you got to come up with a couple of cock a pee pee doo doo jokes to get the crowd back.
Thanks for checking, by the way.
See, that was nice of me. Huh?
Yeah, that was very nice of you.
Call professional, David.
Well, Do you find that people, that the younger generation that grew up in a more sort of multicultural, diverse, sensitive world, you have to be more careful around them in terms of the humor?
They're definitely more, whoever raised them, I guess, raised them right for this, you know, multicultural Benetton world of, you know, holding hands and drum circles and all that kind of stuff. So they're totally cool with that. Like, you know, I'm older and, you know, an old drunk and everything like that. So I think a lot of the stuff I talk about, they just find, you know, creepy and weird. But I would say that the worst part with the crowds of today, as opposed to when I started, is just that there's so much more fun things to do than listen. You know, like you've got your iPhone droid right there, and I see it in the crowds. People are texting, Twittering, taping, you know. They're like doing all these things but watching the show.
Mm-hmm.
They're just sitting there, and you feel like you're kind of like, you know, hey, you know, what's this about? You know, it's really difficult because they're not really heckling you, but they're not really respecting you or watching you. So, you know, that's like a new thing that's happened, I'd say, over the last 3 years.
The distractible crowds.
Yeah, so they're like basically, you know, really hard ADD. You know, it's very hard to keep them locked into the show, you know.
Does it make you more inclined to maybe interact with them a little bit more or put a little more pressure on the audience?
Yeah, sometimes, you know, you flip out and you go like, put down that phone, you know, this is life, you're living it right now, you can do that anytime, you know, these are your best years. You say all that kind of stuff, but then at the end you realize you're like, what did I just do? That was ridiculous, you know. So I don't think there's any, I think you just got to kind of deal with it and move forward. And, you know, I was always the kind of guy who would mix it up with the crowd, but now I see, like, they really don't want that. They just want to be entertained and then move on to the next, you know, flash mob, you know, Angry Birds marathon thing. So
I'm speaking with David Tell, who's going to be at the Punchline a week from tonight on the 29th and 30th of December. How important is booze to a comedian?
I don't know. I always like a drunk, wild crowd that's up for anything, but those are getting harder and harder to find. I mean, I think a lot of these people have gotten the message that, like, you know, a 2-3 drink minimum is it. And, you know, the weird times is when you go to, like, a Midwestern town and they've been drinking all day long and then they come to the club. And they're not even out of control. They're just, like, catatonic. You're like, wow, I really do suck. Oh, no, they were just at the beer pong festival. You know, they're all sunburned and, you know, wasted looking. So I would say that, yeah, it's cool when the crowd gets a chance to relax. I mean,
and you've traveled all over the world. I mean, you're pretty well known. You've played Brazil, you've played England, Germany, all over the place, right? Japan. How is
I'm not you too though? I mean, I played like a bar somewhere on an army base in Japan, in Germany and Japan and stuff like that. I didn't play like an amphitheater. There was nobody waving at or for free, you know, free Darfur behind me.
So you don't have to adjust what you do for the different sensibilities of different audiences, because it sounds like you're mostly getting Americans who are abroad.
No, I think it's funny because overseas you get expats and like a couple of locals, but mostly I've done like mostly USO shows overseas, so like troops, Afghanistan, with it. So they're American, and no, I've done a couple of where there were other troops from the NATO alliance. But it's funny whenever I'm in New York, the whole crowd is like tourists, so it's like they're from Germany, they're from Norway, they're from Singapore, you know, they're from Jordan, you know, Israel, so. It's weird that, like, you know, you got to go to, I don't know where you can go now to get like a typical New York crowd. I can't find it.
I was actually in New York recently, and I was looking in Time Out New York, the number of comedy shows that are still going there and the number of free or really cheap nights that you can go see comedy is pretty stunning.
Yeah, I think that explains why the tourists come, because, you know, they always love a deal, you know? Mm. But I think they think they're going to see like Robin Williams or Jerry Seinfeld, so they're like super disappointed with my ugly face. You know, they know like the big shows, you know, Ray Romano and anything that's been exported overseas.
And does comedy inherently sort of keep you in touch with the street? I mean, if you're traveling that many nights out of the year, you're in and out of a lot of parking garages and talking to a lot of people in coffee shops and things, right?
Yeah, I mean, comedy is, that's a good question because, like, there's a lot of ways to answer it. One of them is, like, I used to do a show where I talked to everybody on the street, you know, the Insomnia show. The new show I do now, Dave's Old Porn on Showtime, is about me and comics talking to legendary porn stars like Ron Jeremy, Nina Hartley, you know, people who were in the golden age of porn. So the good thing about comedy is at some point, you kind of learn to talk to everybody.
Speaking of Dave's Old Porn, your current show on Showtime, how many old porn stars are you going to be able to find to keep this thing going? It sounds like it has a limited shelf life.
Well, I'm an optimist, and I like to think, who are you, my dad? It really is so many legendary stars, and you know, we've done shows with the legends, the icons, and then we've done shows with the porn stars of today and had them come in and look at the retro stuff. And I think the cool thing about the concept is that it's really more of a comedy show than it is a sex show. And it's really more about, like, you know, it's unscripted, uncensored. So it's really just about like a cool late night hangout kind of show. And the fact that we get to show some of this great retro stuff just adds to it, you know?
Is there something inherently funny about porn?
Yeah, well, if you watch them the way I do, which is from beginning to end, which nobody does, and I don't think you're supposed to, I think that almost like goes against the, you know, thing of porn is that you're supposed to watch so you don't need to watch it and then immediately do something else. But like we kept watching all the way to the end, and, you know, there's just so many funny, especially in the retro stuff, you know, action scenes and just like crazy dramatic scenes and really great corny over-the-top dialogue. And, you know, that's the stuff that we really celebrate and watch and, you know, comment on when we do the show.
Well, Dave Attell, good luck with your show and thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me and thanks for helping me get the word out. I really, really appreciate it.
My
pleasure. See you guys in Sacramento.
I spoke with Dave Attell last week. He starts his two-night stand at the Punchline in Sacramento a week from tonight. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Nick Bruner with this week's sound advice. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Sacramento woke up to crystal clear conditions today as we head towards the final 3 days before Christmas, and things don't seem likely to change right through the weekend. It's going to be gorgeous. Today's highs in the valley will be in the high 50s, though it'll get down to the low 20s overnight. In the mountains, it'll be just above freezing during the day and very cold at night, down into the single digits at both Tahoe and Reno, but clear and sunny as far as the forecasts can see. Every week, Insight invites one of our local music experts to share some music they like. And this week, we're lucky enough to have sound advice from Nick Bruner, the new host of Blue Dog Jam on Saturday night.
Hey, David.
Welcome to Insight.
Thanks very much.
What you got?
I was asked to put together some of the best of the year, which is a daunting task, even if you have an entire hour to talk about it, much less less than 10 minutes before 11 o'clock. So I guess we'll launch right into it. I thought this was one of the most overlooked and best albums of the year. It's from one of the members of the Fiery Furnaces. Her name is Eleanor Friedberger, and she released her solo album back in June called Last Summer.
You and me could go on and on and on and on, but it's not enough to not get along. And when you see my face and you see it's changed, you can't replace. No, the years we can rearrange.
Sounds a little poppier than the Fiery Furnaces to me.
She is definitely the pop side. Her brother, Matthew Friedberger, released sort of this double album of kind of experimental noise. So you can see when the two come together, you've got your Fiery Furnaces, but separately, you've got what you like. It's like a frosted mini wheat. If you like your wheat side, you got Matthew. If you like your sugary pop side, you've got Eleanor.
Okay. I haven't heard that metaphor before. But I like
I just made it up just now.
Oh, wow, that's good. That's good.
The next up is Bill Callahan, and his latest album really struck me, I want to say in the late summer. It's called Apocalypse. He has been just going like gangbusters. He released 12 albums under the name Smog, and in 2007 started using his given name, all the while been making records on Drag City out of Chicago. This is a track called America.
America. America, I watched David Letterman in Australia. Oh, America, you are so grand and golden. I wish I was on the next flight to America.
That's an interesting background sound. I like it. Sounds like a little sample of a distorted guitar or something, but it doesn't.
It's a lot of fun. He goes on to sort of kind of weave this imagery about his favorite folk singers that have kind of inspired him, but he gives them titles like General and Admiral, and he just talks about what a great country it is and how he's never served it. So he's kind of talking about what the idea of America is, and then how he's sort of introspective about, you know, what it really means internally to him. All over like 5.5 minutes. It's one of the standout records tracks on that record this year.
And we should mention that he was also on the Presidents of Great and Mortal Men 3-CD set that was made by Christian Kiefer and Matty Gerken a few years ago.
He was one of many standout artists who contributed to that record. I think Alan Sparhawk of Low was on there. It was just this cavalcade of indie rock folks. And yeah,
on a local production.
Absolutely.
And speaking of local.
Speaking of local, the next two are some of the best, I figure, from the year. I was going to play Sister Crayon, but I bring Sister Crayon to Sound Advice a lot, and not to mention they just played the Submerge 100th episode show.
And we had them on the show last Friday, too.
Exactly. Track, right? So they've been all over the place. They got all kinds of exposure. I'd like to talk a little bit about what I'm sure your favorite blog has been hailing as a reinvention of hip-hop. These guys are called Death Grips. MC Ride, Zach Hill, Mexican Girl, Info Warrior, and Flatlander make up the band. Their free release is called X Military, and this is the intro track, Beware.
I close my eyes and seize it. I press my fist and beat it. I light my torch and burn it. I worship, I close my eyes and seize it. I clench my fists and beat it. I light my torch and burn it. I am the beast I worship.
That's a new disc, Death Grip, local band. And Zach Hill's an amazing local drummer, so that's live drums, huh?
Yeah, he's been eternally busy for the last, I don't know how many years, a solo record, this album, and a new Hella record, all just this year alone. So it's well worth listening to. The whole thing is just this whole, it's like an ancient Gaelic poem about the end of the world in hip-hop form. So, you know, for the kids.
Yeah, okay.
And almost on the opposite spectrum of that is a guy called Teddy Briggs. He makes music under the name Appetites, and he released Scattered, Smothered, Covered, an album on Crossbill Records this year.
That's your last choice?
Appetite, Scattered, Smothered, Covered, a great record, again, out on Crossbill Records. You can find an interview that I did with Teddy Briggs up on the Inside page this week.
All right, and we can also hear a lot more music that you like on Saturday nights on Blue Dog Jam.
Correct.
Nick Bruner, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, David.
And that's Insight for today and for 2011. Insight's assistant producers are James Morrison and Lynn Weaver. Today's associate producers were Sossin Marar and Sarah Jung. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's theme music was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Our senior producer is Jen Picard, who is going off on maternity leave for the next few months to bring a new baby girl into the world, and we wish her and her husband Max great joy and lots of rest. Our executive producer is Joe Barr. I'm David Watts Barton. Thanks for listening. Happy New Year, and we'll see you in 2012.